You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, everybody. If you're enjoying the podcast, can you do me one favor? Give us a nice review, will you? Star us on iTunes. Leave a comment. Let everyone know how you feel about it. If you don't like the podcast, well, press stop right now because one is about to start.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Producer's Perspective podcast. I'm Ken Davenport. I'm very fortunate to have on today's show one of the top director choreographers in the business. Please welcome to the podcast three-time Tony Award winner, Ms. Kathleen Marshall. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you, Ken, for that very generous introduction.
Well, all true, just facts. Kathleen won her Tonys for Anything Goes, Pajama Game, and Wonderful Town. She also directed and choreographed Nice Work, If You Can Get It, the revival of Grease, subject of the reality show, You're the One That I Want, I discovered Laura Osnes, and this season's In Transit. Worked on a ton of other shows. We don't have time to list all of them, so let's just get into it. So, something tells me you got your start in the theater at a young age, being from a very show business family that you're in. Tell me a little bit about that.
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and with my brother and sister, Rob and Mara, who were a couple years older than me and were twins. And my parents are actually academics, if you can believe it. Both taught at the University of Pittsburgh. My father in the English department, my mom was the head of the elementary education graduate program. But they were big theater fans and all kinds of theater, and took us to see everything from a young age. You know, opera, ballet, Shakespeare, musicals, symphonies, just everything that there was to see in Pittsburgh. And one of the great things about growing up in Pittsburgh is that it was sort of a medium-sized city that had everything, had all those cultural institutions and parks and sports teams, and you could get to it. You know, unlike big cities that have a lot of things going on, but you can't get access. And somehow Pittsburgh, you could get access to things. You could get tickets. You could afford tickets. You didn't have to stand in line for 3 days to get tickets. So we just saw everything. And didn't start dancing until I was like 13, but we, you know, performed in our schools and Pittsburgh Symphony Opera shows, just kind of as amateurs. And so really was a fan before I ever thought it was something to be a part of.
And when was that moment when you were like, oh, I want to do this as a career?
You know, when we were kids, my brother, sister, and I all auditioned for Pittsburgh Symphony Opera, which is a big summer stock company in Pittsburgh, who's doing Sound of Music. And We saw an ad in the paper and said, we want to go down and audition. My parents were like, you know, your kids who like come out and take music class at school and put on shows in the living room, you're not professionals, but we'll drive you down to the audition. And all three of us got in, and we're three of the Von Trapp children in a production that's. And what was fun about that is that it was the last show of the season. And through the season, the director was very smart. He brought us in like a couple of times every week, you know, to rehearse the Von Trapp children. So we, on our breaks, we'd go and watch all the other shows being rehearsed. And it was our first time kind of seeing that world. And so then when I did, a couple of years later, start taking dance, I sort of thought, well, this could be something that I might be interested in pursuing. And then was able to get my equity card a few years later, because we saw that offer in the ensemble.
So you really stayed at Pittsburgh CLO for years.
Oh, yeah. All through college. I went to college at Smith College in Massachusetts, but all through college, and this is my summers, I'd go home and dance in the chorus at CLO.
And when and how did you make that transition from, okay, performing thing isn't going to be for me, I want to be the person who makes up these things?
You know, it was interesting. I mean, I think, you know, I choreographed some shows in college, and I was dance captain and assistant to some people, even at CLO. But really the big break came through my brother, Rob. My brother, Rob Marshall, who was, you know, also a dancer on Broadway, who became an assistant choreographer to Grazia La Danielle. I was actually touring in a production of Cats when Rob was brought in to, went to Toronto to work on a new musical that was out of town and then heading to London and heading to Broadway. They wanted some additional help in choreography, and Graciela Danielle and Rob went up, and then Graciela couldn't continue with it but said, you should continue with Rob, and that musical was Kiss of the Spider. And so Rob called me, I was on the road with Cats, and said, and I'd assisted him on a couple of other things that he'd started to choreograph, and he said, do you want to come work with me on this new musical? It's Candor and Ebb and Terrence McNally and Hal Prince and Gia Rivera. It's like,
Never heard of
them. Yeah. Who are they? Yeah. So I was like, yeah, I think I'd like to come work on that project. And then from there, I assisted him on several other shows.
Oh, so interesting working with your brother. You learned the business together coming up. So did you find you have the same dance vocabulary?
I think choreography is really an apprenticeship art. I mean, if you look at it, you know, I assisted my brother, and my brother assisted Graciela Danielle. Graciela Danielle assisted Bob Fosse. Bob Fosse was supervised on his first musical by Jerome Robbins. You know, Rob Ashford assisted me. You know, I mean, it's all Casey Nicholaw was in the ensemble of shows that I choreographed, that Rob Ashford choreographed. I mean, you know, Mark Rooney was my assistant director on many shows. Now he's directing on his own. And I think it just all sort of all intertwines. And I think, you know, that's one thing about being a director choreographer is you get to see other directors in action.
When you started to choreograph, did you think, okay, one day I'm going to direct as well? Was this always the trajectory for you?
No, I mean, I think, you know, it's like anything. Opportunities sort of come up in a way. I mean, I was still actively dancing and pursuing a performing career when I started assisting my brother. And there were a couple of shows where he sort of said, okay, you're going to, you know, you have to decide, you can audition and be in this show or you can be the assistant. But I can't have an assistant who's in the show. I need somebody, an assistant who's out with me and watching the show. Because there were a couple of things that I'd done with him when I was in the show. And assisting him with the tour of the Mystery of Evan Rude. And so then it sort of was like, oh no, I like being on this side. And really a couple of years had gone by where I was assisting my brother and I had realized, oh, I guess I'm not performing anymore. It wasn't like a conscious decision like, oh, I'm stopping that and now I'm going on to this. It's just that the opportunities were so wonderful and so creative and interesting to pursue on the other side of it.
Do you remember what it was? Because it's obviously two very different personalities that, oh, I want to continue to be on the stage, or no, I want to be the person that tells the people on the stage. Do you remember what it was about it that attracted you to the other side?
I think I've always been interested in the big picture. I mean, even Susan Shulman, who's a wonderful director who gave me my equity card at Pittsburgh Symphony Opera, and who I actually choreographed shows for later on, she said that I would always was the one raising my hand saying, aren't we all supposed to be doing this? And, you know, aren't we, you know, and asking the bigger questions about, you know, when you're in the ensemble, like, who are we and what is our attitude supposed to be? So I think that the big pictures have always interested me. And I think I admire the sort of very focused determination that it takes to be a successful performer. But I feel like I didn't have that particular skill and drive.
I'm going to ask you one of my few James Lipton-like questions, which is, I call this one the bar stool question. I want you to imagine you're on a bar stool in some little hick town in the Midwest, and you cozy up, and a guy cozies up right next to you and says, who has never seen a theater show ever, and says, what do you do? How do you describe what a director does to someone who's never seen a show before?
That's an interesting question, because you're right. There are a lot of civilians who sort of don't understand what a director does. I mean, you can see what an actor does. You can see even what a musician does. But same thing with producing. People have no idea what a producer really does, do they?
I have no idea what they do. Anyway, that's another story.
Well, I always say, when people ask what a producer is, I always say, look at the title page of the playbill. You see all those names on that title page? The producer got them all to do this, on board to do this show. The producer put all those people together to make this show happen. And I sort of feel like that as a director, you know, your job is basically to get the most creative people you can in a room, you know, from the writing team to the design team to the musical team to the cast, and try to all get them on the same page and tell the same story. And I think, you know, a lot of times I sort of joke and sort of say that, you know, as a director, you can't assume anything. That your job is to sometimes state the obvious. And part of that is, like, everybody know we're doing a comedy here? what is the style of the piece we're doing? What is the story we're telling? What is the means by which we're going to tell this story? And just sort of, you know, lead, inspire, and shepherd, and also, you know, receive all the ideas and filter all the ideas of how we're going to all tell this story so that we're all telling the same story in the same style.
Directors, I find, have to have lots of skills. So they have to have a concept for the production. They have to work really well with actors. They have to be dramaturgs at the same time. Of all the things that a director does, what do you think is the most important to a director's success?
I think it's to make sure you communicate with everybody, you know, because you need everybody. And that means there's the obvious people in the room, but there's the people outside of the marketing team and the public relations team and your producers and your general managers. I mean, you're sort of the conduit for all of that and to what's going to end up on stage. And I think the most important thing is just making sure that everybody's heard, because I think that's important. I mean, it's your job to sort of then edit all the ideas, but I think it's part of your job is to make sure everybody's ideas are heard and that everybody feels that they're contributing and that we're all working on the same show.
Following up to that question, what's the one thing that you do as a director that you think the public would be shocked to hear that you is your job? Or to put it another way, when you started directing and someone said, hey, you got to do this, you were like, I have to do this? This is my job? Is there anything like that that you're surprised that you have to do?
Well, I think budgets, you know, I mean, that you're really, when you're putting together a show, you're very much responsible for the budgets and you're going to have to be dealing with trims, you know, a budget comes in for the scenery or the costumes or the lighting, and even before that, the size of the cast, the size of the band. You're always sort of negotiating and trying to figure out, you know, what show we're doing and how to make it viable and how to sort of meet the expectations of what the audience is going to see, but also make it economically feasible. We all want a show that can, you know, run for a long time, especially a commercial Broadway show. But even in, you know, regional productions, you're everywhere you go, you're dealing with the budget, you're dealing with what are the limitations and how can I be as creative as possible within whatever those given limitations are. And it, whether it's, you know, a show at Encores for 2 weeks of rehearsal or a regional production or off-Broadway or a commercial Broadway production, you have to sort of understand the scope and scale of the constraints of what you're dealing with.
I want to jump back to the choreographic part of what you do. I think everyone out there knows how a writer writes a scene. They sit down, they write it, or a composer writes at a piano. But choreography is something different. What's your process for designing a number, building a dance? How do you do it?
I mean, it's similar to a writer composer in that you are facing a blank page. You know, as a director, I mean, of course, as a director, you're guiding the writing, especially if it's a new project, and you're, as you said, working as a dramaturg in some ways. But when it comes to actually rehearsing a scene, you've got a script, you've got a set, you've got actors, you're all going to get in the room and something's going to happen. As a choreographer, that same something's going to happen, but only when you say, okay, everybody start on your left foot, or everybody start on your right foot. You know, you have to be ready to, you have to prepare the actual steps. And for me, it's always about going into the story, you know, of the characters and who are they and why would they dance and how would they dance and, you know, what's the, I love research. So if it's a show that's a period show, whether it's a nice movie, you can get it. And I just researched all kinds of dance from from that time. And I found some old footage of Josephine Baker that really inspired me, and cotton footage and And so it wasn't just a typical Charleston, but it had a sort of new style to it. And so it's doing research and looking at all of that. But then it's also figuring out the characters. And I always find when, you know, I play a lot with vocabulary, you know, and then we're also sort of shaping the dance. And if you're working on a new show and you're working with your dance arrangements, you're trying to figure out with your dance arranger what the story of the dance is going to be. But I always find if I'm having trouble coming up with actual steps, with actual vocabulary, it's because I don't know why they're dancing, you know, and that I have to go back and say, well, who are they? Are they expressing joy? Are they expressing frustration? Is there actual story and plot they're telling? Or is it just an expression of emotion? Is it spontaneous? Is it a show within a show kind of number? How is the number going to build? When have you earned the right to do something in unison? You know, that kind of thing. And so I always feel like if I can't come up with a step, and there are times you just want to open the window and yell, anybody got a step out there? I don't have a step. And I feel like if I get to that point where I'm really stuck, it's because I have to go back to this sort of story and character and emotional reason why that dance is happening.
So I want to talk about a specific number of yours, but before I do that, let's go back to James Lipton and channel him for a second. I want you to imagine that the Smithsonian Institute calls you and says, Kathleen, you choreographed some amazing numbers and we want to put one in the Institute.
Okay.
Which one? We only have room for one. All your numbers, which would you want stored forever?
Oh my gosh, that's hard. You know, I think I might say Toot Our Mott from Kiss Me Kate, because it was one of the first big musicals that I did and where I was able to do, you know, with original dance arrangements and create something. And Tudor and Hawk takes place as the opening of the second act, but in the story, it's intermission of the show, of the, you know, the taming of the true, the show of the show. And what was fun about that is starting from a place that's so familiar to us and to our world, which is what do actors do at intermission? And I just started kind of thinking about that and thinking how sort of people half get out of their costumes. And they're sort of sexy because they're in their sort of half underwear and half costume, but you know, you need the boots on because they take too long to unlace and put back on again. And people are smoking and some people are stretching and have their heads in the show. Other people are sort of checking in on their, I mean, this is in the 40s, so they're checking in on the ball game. They're reading a magazine. They're having a Coke, having smoke. So I sort of feel like the first place I started from was just what really happens, you know, to actors and stagehands and musicians, what do they do at intermission? And then we just kind of built it from there, and it became this, and I didn't know how long the number was going to be, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew it was going to end up being this kind of free-for-all, this party, and it was going to end with everybody sort of passed out on the floor, and the stage manager running in and saying, places for act two, places for act two. And that's all I knew when we started it, and then it turned into this, like, it ended up being like 11 minutes long, this number, but it had all these really fun sections and can you top this kind of challenges to it, and it was really, really fun to build.
So I love that story because it comes from story. It comes from those character places. And I think you touch on something that I think a lot of people out there don't realize is that when you're choreographing on Broadway, it's not like when you're doing something at a regional theater, you don't get air. You're right. 30 bars of music filled with dance.
Right.
You didn't know how much music there was going to be.
Right.
It's a blank canvas.
Yeah.
And the dance arranger, so tell me a little bit about that arrangement on how you say, here's what I want.
Right. Well, I've worked with David Chase, who's the most amazing dance arranger, musical director, conductor, vocal arranger extraordinaire. And we've worked together on almost every Broadway show I've done. And what's fun is that you sort of just do all the what ifs and all the what ifs. And we knew we wanted to go through tempo changes. We knew we wanted this to start from a really slow, slow place and build to something. And, you know, so we would say to him, well, I know I want to have, you know, the girls section or the guys section, or I want to have this challenge section, or I want to have this trio. I know I want to have this sort of sexy trio. And he would just play with riffs and variations on the melody. And then we'd go, oh, yeah, that one. And then we'd start working on it and say, okay, that's great, but can we expand that a little bit more? I love that the feel of that section. Can that expand from 4/8 to 8/8? And then we have to figure out, okay, what's the next section going to be and how we're going to transition to that. And at the end of it, I knew, because it was like 40s, you know, swing music. And I knew his, you know, piece that I love so much, and it's a reason that every choreographer's used it, is Sing, Sing, Sing. You know, the way Sing, Sing, Sing builds that Betty Goodman arrangement. I said, I knew I wanted to have that thing that Sing, Sing, Sing has at the end, which is just sort of around and around and around and relentless until it sort of reaches its peak and finishes. And so the last section of our Toot Our Mott arrangement, even though it doesn't use the melody of Sing, 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 uses the structure of Sing, Sing, Sing. In terms of just It goes around, and then it blasts off. And that, so it's really fun to sort of just play, but it takes a long time. You know, we meet over the course of many, many months, sort of just coming up with ideas, and then kind of slowly spiraling into the center of what you want.
So you mentioned before Fosse, which certainly he had his style. Michael Bennett has his style.
Yeah.
How would you describe Kathleen Marshall's style?
I don't know if I do. I mean, I love Fosse, I love Bennett. I also so admire Jerome Robbins because I sort of feel like we think that he did Fiddler on the Roof, West Side Story, you know, Gypsy. I mean, it's just sort of amazing that he, King and I, that his style would be sort of subjugated to whatever show he was working on. You know, I mean, Fosse crystallized those movements, and so we know that you can't grab a bowler hat with your index finger and your thumb and your other fingers out without thinking of Fosse. And Robbins was sort of the opposite, in which that his, you couldn't necessarily tell it was the same person from show to show, because he just changed his style depending on whatever style of the show he was working on. So I think that's it. I mean, although I do love athletic dancing. I love numbers that have a nice big build to them. I like to sort of have individuality within the ensemble, to try to give some texture to that and some story to that, so that it's not just sort of anonymous chorus people all dancing in unison.
What kind of stories do you think make the best musicals? What does the story need to have? What are the necessary ingredients?
That's a good question. I think that, you know, certainly it's interesting. I'm mentored with a group called Open Doors, which is through TDF that brings high school students to see Broadway musicals and plays. And I've done this for about 13 years now. And they're all sort of usually 16 and 17-year-old kids from Queens and Brooklyn and other neighborhoods. And some of them have never seen a show before. And you know what they all respond to? I mean, they love seeing spectacle. They love great music. They love plot. And they love story. And they love characters that they care about. And so to feel like, you know, at the heart of anything, no matter, you can have all the sort of bells and whistles, and you can have sort of fabulous music and fabulous choreography and a spectacular production. But I think people respond to stories, and people respond to sort of human connection, stories of human connection.
Yeah, you're so right about that, and proven by how many cast recordings I own that I listen to where the show's flopped. Where the music was great, and the music isn't the reason it didn't work, but the story,
right,
for whatever reason, didn't function. So just dovetailing off that, you get pitched, I'm sure, a ton of projects to work on. How do you personally say, oh yeah, this one is for me?
Well, so much of it is for me as a choreographer is responding to the music. Certainly, you know, I mean, the story, the characters, but the music. You know, do you want to, can you see yourself living with these songs? Because, you know, when you pick a project, you know, you may be living with it for several years or more. And it's like thinking, do I want to be around these people, these characters, and around this music for the next several years of my life? And so that's a big part of it for me. It's interesting with In Transit that's running now. It's a contemporary musical, which is fun for me to do because I haven't gotten a chance to do a lot of them. And it's really cool because it's a cappella. So it's all, I mean, there is no band. The cast is the band. And you've got beatboxer and vocal percussionists. And it's just unlike anything you've ever heard. And even though it's a contemporary New York story, and I sort of responded to it. I read it and I sort of thought, this is like a modern-day Condon and Green musical. This is sort of a musical that's a love letter, a Valentine to New York City, that sort of embraces New York in all its sort of quirkiness, and that, like the classic comedy of the musicals, like Wonderful Town or Bells Are Ringing or On the Town, it takes the big city and turns it into a small town. And all of these characters, their lives intersect in sort of surprising and interesting ways. And I sort of thought, okay, I like these people. I like these characters. I like this music. I want to spend time with these people.
You've done a lot of revivals. Do you prefer new musicals or revivals, one or the other? Or if you could only do one for the rest of your life, which would it be?
That's a tricky question. I mean, obviously with new musicals, it's nice going into sort of uncharted territory. They just take a lot longer, as you know. They take a long time. I mean, how long did Spring Awakening take, you know, the original production? And I mean, involved in Kinky Boots, and that was a long, many, many years in development. And so there's something nice about a revival, you know, that can come together in a more timely way, which is also sort of satisfying. You know, that if the right property and the right, sometimes they require a star, but if the right casting and the right property come together, it can happen within a couple of years, which is fun to do. And I also think it's fun to sort of reimagine these shows for a contemporary audience and thinking, you know, when I want them to have the same experience that the audience had in maybe the 1940s or 50s seeing this musical, but how can we make it fresh for a contemporary audience? You know, so that was one of the fun things about Anything Goes. I mean, everybody's seen Anything Goes in their high school, college, and summer stock. So it's like, how can I deliver an Anything Goes that sort of meets the expectations of people who know and love that musical, but also give them some fresh surprises and delights?
When you're working on a new musical, are you the type of director that likes to come on very early before much is written, or do you like to wait for the draft to be done?
I mean, I've done both. I've come on board when there's sort of, you know, here's a draft, here's some songs, and but it's also nice to be involved in sort of figuring out, you know, okay, where else do we need a song, and where else, you know, who should sing and why, and how do we wrap up the story? And I mean, I just got on a project. I don't know if be involved with it or not, but I know the writers and they haven't written the ending of the show yet. And so part of my meeting with them is kind of spitballing ideas about, well, what could the ending be? And whether that will happen or not, who knows? But it's sort of, it's fun to be in the ground floor and that kind of stuff.
Now, you are married to a producer.
Yes.
And a very good one, Mr. Scott Landis.
Yeah.
What makes a good producer on Broadway in 2016, do you think?
Well, I've learned more about producing in the last 10 years than I ever thought I'd want to know. It's complicated because producing is, you know, there's the business side of it, and there's the creative side of it, and there's the personal side. And I think a good producer needs to do all of those well. I mean, you need to, if you're managing a business, you're managing, you know, a big budget business, and that, but ultimately Broadway, as you know, I sort of think of it like a mom and pop store. It's like you've got to make more money every week than you spend and try to, you know, keep the lights on and pay the employees. So there's that business side of it. There's the creative side of it, which, you know, especially if you're shepherding a project from early on, the producer may be involved in putting the team together. You know, you may start with just a property that you have the rights to or an idea that you have, and you're putting together, you're going to a writer, a composing team, and a director and saying, does this project interest you? But then I think what's really so key is the personal connection, because I think, you know, there's a lot of, as we all know, there are a lot of producers above the title these days, but most of them are not necessarily hands-on involved with the creative team in a very personal and direct way. And I think, you know, there's a lot of, you know, it's a kind of scary process to put yourself out there in a creative way and hoping that everybody likes it. And your first sort of feedback often comes from your producer in terms of, are we on the right track? Do you like the direction we're going? And I think having a producer whose taste you trust and who you feel has your back in terms of wanting you to sort of succeed creatively is really essential.
You work for nonprofit theaters as well as commercial producers. Difference between the two?
Yeah, I mean, it's all, even in the not-for-profit world, you know, they're trying to sell tickets, and even if they have subscribers, they've got to please their subscribers, they've got to hope their subscribers re-up for next season and hopefully sell some single tickets beyond that. So everybody's sort of facing that same sort of need to create something that is that the audience will connect with and want to see. You know, obviously there's a little more of a safety net with the not-for-profits that you're not, you know, you can do a successful limited run of the show and feel like it's done well. Whereas a commercial Broadway production, you're sort of out there for the world to see in terms of, you know, they're not printing the grosses of the more theater companies, right? Maybe know how many subscribers they have, but they're not getting their, you know, grosses printed every Monday and everybody can see how your show is doing. So it's more exposed, certainly, in the commercial Broadway world.
What do you think Broadway looks like in 20 years?
You know, I think it'll be somewhat similar. I mean, I think that, you know, even if you look 20 years ago, I mean, you know, there was always been a variety on Broadway. There's always been a variety of, you know, serious plays and family musicals, blockbuster shows, experimental shows. I think the tricky thing on Broadway right now is these mega, mega hits that run for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. And it means that it sort of somehow sets the bar of success at a very high level that's really not necessarily achievable. You know, I think 40, 50 years ago, a show would run a season and be a success and earn its money back and you know, everybody was happy. And now it sort of feels like a show to sort of really be deemed a success has to be one of those mega shows that runs for years and years and produces, you know, multiple companies around the world. So I think, you know, real estate's always going to be an issue in New York City, as it always is. I wish we had a couple more 15 to 1600 seat theaters, as I'm sure you and every producer does. But I think that, you know, Broadway will always be a place that has a sort of combination of, you know, tourist-friendly mega musicals and also still some experimental and groundbreaking shows.
You mentioned Bennett and Fosse, Robbins, and your brother. Yeah. A lot of men in that picture. Was it challenging being a female director choreographer and breaking into this obvious boys' club?
You know, I'm lucky in that, you know, Susan Schulman gave me my equity card, so it's like the first professional director I really worked with was a woman. And when I was at City Center, and Judith Dakin was the executive director there and hired me to choreograph and direct shows at Encores and then to be the artistic director there for a few years. And so I'm lucky that I've had these sort of wonderful role models, and I haven't really thought about it much. You know, you sort of feel like you're just kind of doing your, trying to do your work. But you realize that it is kind of a small club. Somebody told me, and I haven't actually looked to see if this is actually true, that I'm the only woman who's directed a play on Broadway, directed a musical on Broadway, and choreographed a musical on Broadway. So I did a play a year ago, and I was like, wait, you didn't? Some Graciela DeMille directed a play, or Agnes DeMille directed a play, and I don't know if they have, but, you know, so it's still a small group. But I mean, it's amazing as to see what Diane Paulus and Susan Stroman and now Richard Chafin and, I mean, these wonderful, you know, Silverman, and there's also besides the sort of old guard of ladies, there's a sort of new, very exciting group of women coming up.
Advice to that young lady that Pittsburgh CLO this summer raising her hand saying, what's her motivation at the ensemble? She wants to just...
Well, to quote a show everybody knows a little bit about, you just want to be in the room where it happens. And I think that, I said, I think choreography really and direction for that matter is sort of an apprenticeship art, and you want to get in the room and watch other people do it. And I sort of feel like as much as you can, you do your own work, do your own shows, but watch other people work. I think I was very lucky as being an assistant choreographer to my brother and being a choreographer before I became a director. I watched Hal Prince and Jack O'Brien and Michael Blakemore and Jerry Zaks and Susan Schulman and all these people at work, and so I got to see how they run auditions, how they talk to writers, how they talk to designers, how they run a tech, how they run a production meeting, how they give notes, and all those things that you, unless you witness it, and I think it's different witnessing it from the point of view of an actor or something else, unless you're actually sort of, you know, off the shoulder of the director, watching them and how they interact with other members of the team and the company, it's really informative, and it can inform ways that you want to work and ways that you don't.
My last question, and the last of the James Lipton, my genie question. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to you, knocks on your door, and says, I want to thank you, Kathleen, for all the work that you've done for Broadway and the inspiration to future choreographers and directors by granting you one book. You're such a lovely woman. What's the one thing that really pisses you off about Broadway that makes you angry, that could get you flipping this desk up, throwing things around, acting like Fosse in a rehearsal, throwing dance bags at people? What's the one thing that makes you so mad that you'd ask the genie to wish away?
to let everybody have the courage of their own convictions of what shows they believe should be produced and put on Broadway and not rely on one or two people's opinions. That's all I'll say. How's that?
Very good answer. Thank you so much for that. Thank you so much for being here and for doing all that you do. Everyone out there, go see Entranz. It's fantastic. And just like you said, I've never seen or heard anything like it, which is exactly the type of stuff I love to see. So thank you for that. Thanks to all of you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe. We'll see you next time.
Don't forget to give us a review on whatever platform you're listening to this on. It'd be much appreciated. Thanks for listening.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical, Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard. So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.